Morning. I'm pleased to call the meeting of our Committee on Veteran Affairs to order this morning. And we'd just like to mention to everyone, today is our day because we have a restaurant right outside the door. So huge cinnamon rolls and coffee, the engineers out there. So I just want to suggest if you want a cup of coffee that maybe we could take advantage of this restaurant outside today. Thank you for being here. The first thing we'd like to do at the beginning of each one of our meetings is, of course, to recognize the individuals for whom we are working diligently. And I'd like at this time to ask our veterans who are here to stand, if you would, and or raise your hand, and we'd like to recognize you. We want you to know we are most grateful for your service, and we do know that freedom wasn't and is not free. For the sake of our committee this morning, I would like to announce that unless we hear otherwise at 10:30, the governor will be holding a press conference on veteran affairs, and you're certainly welcome to attend that press conference. We've not heard it. Hopefully he's feeling better today, but we haven't heard yet, but you're certainly welcome to do so. We're honored today to have Dr. Leslie Berger here, who is the director of the Multistate Regional Office for Veterans Health Care, and this is just so perfect in our timing because we have a critical need right now to develop a task force that will work on the coordination with the Department of Veteran Affairs, our county veteran officers, all of our veteran groups, our family coordinators, to see how we can best coordinate what we're now calling the VetNet. And I love that. And thanks to Diane Salenti, who is the county veteran service officer, happens to be from my county, so I can brag on her. That's how we got this name. So I love it, the vet net, and it's very finely meshed net, and that means we don't know veteran, family, spouses, widows, children can fall out of our net. We want to be sure that we provide statewide services, and we'll just call it the vet net. So we'll be working on that task force to see how we can bring that together. And I do appreciate those who attended the meeting last Wednesday night. We had representation from all of those groups, and it was very beneficial, and we'll just do more of it. Before Dr. Berger comes forth today, I was just thinking maybe you're kin to one of our representatives who has the same name, right? We do have three individuals who are here, and we'd like to call upon them to come forward. And want all members of the audience to know that we simply sign up, and we're happy to listen to any comments about any matters relative to our military and to our veterans. All right. Our first individual we have is Dan. Nope, scratch that. Okay. Next, I'd like to call upon the director of the Coalition for Troop Support, and I believe this is Sue Robertson, and the Deputy Director, Linda Christie, to come forward, if you would, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
We appreciate your driving early this morning to get here, and oh, welcome. You may begin, and before you begin your testimony, it's necessary that you identify yourself. So before you speak for the first time, if you would, please just identify who you are for the record, and then proceed, if you will. Oh, you go first, Ms. Christie.
Okay. Chair Nelson, I'm Linda Christie with the Coalition of Troop Support. We're here today because, as you all know, we have the two of the 162 coming back in a couple of months, and we have some major issues that we're concerned about with them coming back. We all know at this point that they're not considered veterans, and then if they go to the veterans, they're not going to be able to get help at this point. We attended the committee that is trying to get a 1-800 number going, so we know there's things in the process. But we've got things, the National Guard, when they come back after being deployed, they become federal army, regular army people, okay? When they come back at this point, they're getting 2 weeks' pay and sent back to the state as National Guard employees. And that's all, and they're left out on their own. These guys have been going through an awful lot. They have had casualties, 11 of them out of their unit, the 162. And we just really need to know that these guys are going to have the representation that they need to get the help they need when they're here, counseling, help for their families that have not been being helped at this point. The coalition is here, and we've helped a lot. I've got some case histories that I can read, if you will allow me to do that. And this is just not Oregon National Guard, but...
Ms. Christie, would you do us a favor and just move that microphone over a little closer? We have some individuals back of the room that probably can't hear.
Okay. Okay, I'm just going to read off what this is. It says, the Pentagon's pay processes is a mess. Profound financial impact on individual soldiers and their families. There are 6 guard units examined by the General Accounting Office. A stunning 94% of soldiers had pay problems, including under and over payments. More of the first than the last. If an overpayment is made, they take it back 3 or 4 times until they finally get it stopped. 3 months delay in active duty checks. Pay and benefit cutoff for wounded soldiers in the hospital. They were being told they weren't entitled to certain health care benefits in spite of their injuries, explained Shays. I mean, there's no one in the military who justifies that, but it's shocking that it could happen. In one Colorado unit, soldiers had their checks docked to pay off $48,000 each in debt that they did not owe. They were mad, and they still are, insists Sergeant Blair Donaldson of the Colorado Air Guard, and justifiably so. Wednesday night, the Pentagon said only that it's aware of the problem, agrees with the report, and is working to fix the system. On October 29, 2003, the Office of the Secretary of Defense committed to Chairman Davis and Vice Chairman Shays that the Department of Defense would take concrete steps to resolve the pay and allowance errors for the individual Army National Guard units identified in the GAO report. In an attempt to correct overpayments made to 34 soldiers from Colorado's 5th Battalion, 19 Special Forces, finance officials insisted inadvertently billed an average of $48,000 each, or a largely erroneous total debt of over $1.6 million, the report states. 4 soldiers from Virginia's 20th Special Forces were denied medical care for wounds sustained while in Afghanistan because their orders were not processed properly. In a couple of more severe cases, we experienced problems that threw soldiers into turmoil that affected their pay for months, and said the 40-year-old sergeant first class. During mobilization, it was a busy and hectic time for everyone involved, but it is inexcusable that it should take 6 weeks for someone to draw their first paycheck. The Pentagon responded with a one-page letter that read, in part, we are taking concrete steps to fix these problems and are seeking assistance where other units and individuals may have experienced similar problems and fixing them as well. As stated above, and we might say over and over and over again, while people hand our soldiers and their families bureaucratic red tape, they give you their red blood and bones and bodies, and yes, their life. The best we offer them is lip service, broken and bent promises. It is well past time we should get this right. After all, this is called war. It is not new. We are straggling our military pride and spirit with the rightness of red tape, with no solutions other than panel, committee, or board. We continue to use outdated formulas to fix these current problems, streamline current systems. The government, through the years, has done this to our troops at a great savings to them, and many thousands of soldiers through the years have fought and given up on even seeing that money. Someone should ask where the slush fund and all the money through the years has gone. There has to be a better way. There is no reason why the government itself can't resolve this with a fund. After all, they have funds for everything. Why not military families? They should have an emergency fund to cover those major mistakes, pay mistakes, with immediate remedy for the families left behind, with no repayment for the government's mistake. Consider it a penalty for abuse in military families. I can talk from experience. My son is with the 162, or was in 2001 when they were deployed the first time. And I know the problems that my family and I went through getting him over there. He did come back with a medical problem, and he was put on hold. He came back, got his pay, couldn't go back to work, because if he went back to work, it would null and void his claim in the military. He's got three kids. He couldn't wait for the military to fix his problem and put him on hold. They told him he'd have to go through all these processes, and it would take 6 weeks before they could do anything to help him out. In the meantime, he was getting no pay. I virtually went broke trying to keep my kids in their house. And I just think it's horrible. There's got to be a way that the National Guard... my problem, I feel it's a federal problem. They should keep our guys on the Army active duty for 2 months, just like they do with the regular Army guys, and let them decompress like they do in the regular Army. But I won't get off on a tangent because that's not what I'm here for. But thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Christie, and I hope you'll also let your son know that we're grateful for his service.
Thank you. He is still in. He's in Iraq right now. He's over with the Tennessee National Guard. They moved over there. They're right now. So he is back in there.
And we're sorry for his complications. Any questions of Ms. Christie? Vice Chair Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Christie, my question for you is, what was the six-week delay caused by? Was it because he had to submit forms and then receive direction as to where to get medical treatment?
They couldn't resolve what the issue was with him, the medical problem that he had, and they were doing testing, and they told him that it could take up to 6 weeks or 2 months to figure out what was going on and the forms that he had to fill out, and that he would just have to wait and see what they found out, because the Army didn't resolve it as a disability to discharge him from the Army, so they sent him back to the National Guard and said, okay, you guys handle it and find out what's wrong with him and either discharge him or, you know, put him back to duty. So
how was it resolved? Did he eventually receive treatment?
After he signed his waiver, though, we got him help and everything was fine. But the military, well, he signed a waiver. He had to go back to work.
Oh, I see.
You know, so he didn't wait the 6 weeks without paychecks. He signed the waiver after about a month because I couldn't afford to pay the rent and he couldn't afford to feed his kids. And it was just one of those things that we signed it off. And there's a lot of guys that are doing that, doing the same thing. They send them back with 2 weeks' pay and say, here, you're on your own. They have no time to go back to the armory or anything and be with the guys that they've been with for, you know, after coming out of a war situation or whatever situation they were in at the time. They need that decompression time. To unwind.
So what does the waiver constitute?
He's waiving his rights to be, what do I call it, his military rights or whatever. So he waves away stating, okay, I'm okay. I'm going to go back to work because I can't feed my family. So he's waving that he's okay, that he doesn't want the military to take care of it. So I guess, is that how you explain it?
That's exactly right.
So that means then that he didn't receive treatment
right.
That was paid for by the insurance that the military offered.
Yes, exactly.
So he had private insurance or he was on his own?
No, we just paid for it.
Any other questions? Thank you. Ms. Robertson?
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Susan Robertson. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I am the director of the Coalition of Troop Support. I am the wife of a retired Marine, the mother of two active duty military personnel, and one reserve Army soldier who just returned from Iraq. My oldest son is currently in Mosul. Excuse me. During Desert Shield, Desert Storm, I formed a small organization called Operation Homefront in Southern California to ensure and assist our deployed military that we would not stand to see another Vietnam happen, that the troops would receive support from every level possible. When this came up and came around, I assumed that somebody else had already been doing this, and my son said they could use our help here. So we stepped forward, and I spoke with the VFW, the American Legion, Telecom Pioneers, many social groups, churches, schools, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, the general, and everybody thought a coalition was a great idea to help supply for the troops and to assist the families left behind. That's why I find myself here today. Our National Guard families are having tremendous pay problems. They face lack of coordination, inroads where they know exactly where to go, spend 3, 4, 5, 6 days trying to figure out exactly who it is they need to talk to or where they need to go for assistance. I would recommend that the families of National Guardsmen and reservists being activated in the state of Oregon be given a threefold pamphlet that contains all the information that they need, rather than a compilation of papers of 25, 30 pages long with redundant information in it, which they're going to look at and round file, basically, especially when they use it the third or fourth time and find out they're just getting a runaround. For our troops that are currently coming back within the National Guard, there's a lack of communication on issues such as medical health, pay, health assistance, and job resources. And there's also a lack of decompression time, lack of protections for their military careers, as if seeking help for the term that is erroneous these days, such as PTSD. Lack of VA assistance, and when I say lack of VA assistance, I mean it in the strictest sense of the word, that when they come back, they're still on active duty in the sense that they still belong to the Guard. And they do not become a veteran until they receive their discharge, until they are separated. So the VA resources that are available to them, as long as they continue to be active duties within the Guard and the Reserve, are not available until their separation time. If wounded, lack of representation to help them in base hospitals, I've spoken to many of the wounded returning soldiers who are very irritated and frustrated at the fact that they felt, because they were National Guardsmen, they were wounded, they were in a regular military hospital, they did not receive nor felt they received the same treatment as the regular duty military, and they had no one to turn to. If they went to anybody to get any cohesive help, they were told, "I'm not really sure, you're with the National Guard. You will have to deal with that when you get back to your unit." That could be months down the road. The same holds true of lack of representation for the National Guardsmen when they are put into a medical hold battalion aboard a base. Again, they're put into this medical hold battalion due to their condition. There is not a National Guard representative there. Any questions that they have or concerns, they're told to wait until they return to their unit to get the answers. As Linda said, the two of the 162 is getting ready to come back. We've already had advanced party members come back. We have, I believe, the TO for the unit was 884 when they left. They have suffered, if my recollection is right, 11 casualties with this unit. They have several major brain trauma cases, and they also have multiple amputees. These guys, unlike the one of the 162, which returned without any casualties within the unit, have really been on the front lines getting shot at, vehicles blown up, etc., etc. These young men deserve the same consideration as a regular active duty military person, because that is exactly the way they have served this country for the last year, on regular active duty. Our regular units are being brought back. They're being given what is called 10-day stand-down, 5-day work week plus weekend, 14-day stand-down. And they're given approximately a month to a month and a half of decompression time. Now, when I say a month and to decompression time, what that means is they do report into the unit a few hours every day for the 5-day work week. For that period of time, it is not a full work day for them, nor does it contain the regular military duties that they would normally perform. This gives them the opportunity to decompress, to have conversations with people that they have survived this trauma with, to complain and moan about how things are going at home. The kids are too loud. My wife thinks she's in charge. Oh, Lord, you ought to see our bank account. But the military has found by doing this and using this particular prescription and formula that they are reducing the stress cases within the regular military by 72%. That 72% will translate for our Oregon National Guardsmen in not having that time to decompress. We will ultimately have violence within the families, homicides, suicides, and I would take a guess, probably a 32 to 37% divorce rate. I think it is unconscionable that this government takes these young men, throws them into combat, brings them back, gives them 2 weeks' pay, pats them on the back, tells them, welcome home.
And then they go out and can't get a job, and that's the rest is history.
I have real concerns about our Oregon National Guardsmen and Reservists who are treated in such a manner. I don't think that the disparity between our regular military and our National Guard and Reserve units is something that this state should stand for. I'm not sure what the answer is. I pose the problem to you. I would recommend that the state of Oregon stand up to the federal government. Federal government had the call-up. The federal government, who is the ones who have utilized the Oregon National Guard in such a manner, I believe this happened on the federal time, and I think it should be paid on the federal dime. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are either two of you working with the present demobilization group that
yes.
organized with the military department?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are.
And are you, follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are we seeing improvements? I know, just for the fact of the matter on the presentation here, two of these units were under my command. So I'm very familiar with the problems I have and how we finally, years later, got a lot of it resolved. So are you seeing an improvement in what was transpiring 2 years ago?
I'm seeing that after 4 years that there is a genuine effort to try and put a program forward currently. I feel after 4 years that this should already have been in force. We have young men and women who are going to come back and suffer some very devastating effects, in my opinion, unnecessarily.
Madam Chair, just kind of a follow-up. The information you provide is, frankly, not news to the committee. We've heard most of this before, and a lot of the issues you've raised are, in fact, federal issues in which members of the committee are working on, and Representative Hunt and I have been to the same group you mentioned earlier and are pressing forward. The system remains to be broken, no two ways about that, but it is improving.
Yes.
And the easiest thing in an is to try and attack these on an individual basis to try and press things forward. The federal government we're all aware of, and I think there's members of Congress that, as you pointed out, Tom Davis and others, are pressing hard, but it's a challenge. And so I think from my perspective, having been there, seen it, understand exactly the frustrations you have and see the frustrations, and we're trying to put that pressure on them. However effective we may be, remains to be seen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions from the committee? We want to thank both of you, Ms. Robertson and Ms. Christie, for making the effort to be here today. I think the more we talk about our problems, we then know, you know, we must work harder for solutions. And we appreciate you bringing these to our attention today, and we do care, and we're going to do everything we can to cure these ills. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask Paula Brown with the Department of VA to come forward, if you would, for just a moment, since you happen to be here today. Thank you very much, Paula. You've heard these concerns, and I think what the committee would like to know is what is the Department of Veteran Affairs doing to include this 162nd and the 3670th and all of our military in our veterans programs? What can we do? Do we even have a 800 number where individuals can call and immediately get tied to someone who can help them?
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I appreciate that the previous individuals came forward to the committee and brought up these concerns, because it is through hearing those concerns that we're able to assist them. And Representative Boquist did bring up a very important point. As we're moving forward and addressing these issues and having mobilizations and demobilizations more often, there are some very good accomplishments and gains being made on the way these things are handled. And actually, with the mobilizations and the demobilizations, in addition to that, there are family reintegration workshops. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the Employment Department, the Department of Labor, and a number of other organizations that are going to be addressing and working with these returning new veterans when they come back, get together and actually have presentations that they give. Now, what we have found is it is true that when they return, these families are very concerned in being reunited with their families. So they are not interested in having a great deal of information presented. So that part is true. One of the things that the department has done is we developed a Veterans Benefits Resource Guide, and I'll be happy to provide each of the members with a copy of this if you would like. And what we do with this Veterans Benefits Resource Guide is we make sure that we provide this to each returning service member. And we do that in a couple of ways, because we know that sometimes it does make it to the round file, I believe, as Ms. Robertson indicated. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we not only get it into the hands of the service members, but that we get it into the hands of the family members. So when there's a family reintegration workshop and we have the opportunity to talk with the family members, we make sure that they have one of these. And I've actually done some of the workshops myself. And what I tell the families is, I understand when your family member comes back, you're not going to want to be spending a lot of time thinking about benefits, but I tell them this is a very important document, so you need to hang on to it. And it may not be in the first week, it may not be in the second week when your loved one returns, but you need at some point to take a look at these things. So when you have a question about benefits, you can refer to this book, because some of the important issues are the disabilities that are incurred or aggravated by military service. The way the resource guide is set up, we have the very first page is the governor thanking these service members for their service and welcoming them home. The next page is a welcome and thank you from the Director of Veterans Affairs. And then the contents of this, we tried to keep it as simple as possible, because veterans benefits are very complex and you don't want to be overwhelmed. You want to have, what do I need? So if they need to think about education, employment, medical care, they have a particular page they go to. And on that page, it has a very, very short explanation. Usually we tried to keep it to one sentence. And every page has a number, and whenever possible, a toll-free number for veterans to call to ask questions or obtain those benefits. And I know for the Department of Veterans Affairs, we do have a toll-free number. Our toll-free number works after hours as well. So if they call us when we are not during business hours, they have the ability to leave a message. Those messages are checked every morning so that we can get back to those veterans and help them with their benefits. There is sometimes a complicated issue with the activation and then when they're deactivated, getting the DD-214s. But those returning service...
I don't know if we should charge you, if that's an acronym. We'll certainly accept your money today, but could you tell us what that is?
DD-214, I owe you, absolutely.
Department of Defense something?
Department of Defense, Form 214.
Okay. Thank you.
I use it so often that I had to think about that one. Okay, I'm going to mark that down or I'll forget to pay.
We won't let you forget.
Well, from what I understand in watching some of the testimony, I believe it was Dr. Tuchmet with the federal VA that thought that the payment
goodness.
Was a dollar.
Did you? It's instead of 10. Did you just hear the word, the acronym VA?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
well,
that's another one. I better wrap this up. Or
Okay, and so this form, could you tell us, does this form, one form fits all, I would just like to know. This form is for every individual in any military service, Guard, Army, Reserves, Marines, Navy.
Each branch of the service would get a discharge form. It may have a different acronym, but each branch of the service would. And so that's what we're looking for when they come back. However, what we've been doing is working with the military department and the Guard to talk about ways that we're going to make sure that we're able to get the benefits for these individuals when they come back. So some really good gains have been made on that. And, I mean, there are many organizations in Oregon who are working very hard to make sure that these service members do get the benefits that they're entitled to.
Well, excuse me, just one moment. In light of the previous testimony, then when these individuals come home who've been with our Guard, the 162nd we're using as an example, do you see that they are treated as if they were still active, I mean, on the federal government Title 10, that they do get the benefits, the 2 months decompression, all the benefits? Do you see that that happens? I mean, is your tie with the federal government so much that, you know, one call from Director Willis and every one of these men are treated as respectfully as they should be? Do you do this?
Well, I can tell you that we do work with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, which is referred to as the federal VA. We did have an instance where we found that they have been very responsive. We had a situation where we had some returning service members who had not received their exit physicals, and we had the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Federal Veterans Affairs Hospital, I'm trying to be very careful here, in Portland, step up to the plate and make sure, work with us to make sure that all of those returning service members were able to get their physicals. So what we're finding is if we have an issue and we approach the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, they're very responsive to assisting those service members.
We previously heard from our beloved Colonel Caldwell from the Guard that we really don't have funding here for our Guard leadership. I wish Representative Boquist were here so I would use the right terms, but to have the opportunity to assess our at-risk soldiers coming home because we have no money. I mean, it was my understanding that once their feet, you know, are back on American soil, they have 1 week to, you know, get home and back to their job, you know, for 6 months they can, you know, just almost be anonymous in our society rather than having the opportunity to work with the Guard to get together so that, you know, their previous leadership could assess their risk. Will you see is that your job in the Veterans Affairs to see that these men are treated appropriately?
What our job is and what our goal is during the demobilizations is to make sure that these returning service members know that there are benefits available to them and how they're going to access those. And if they have a problem, who they need to contact. So we make every effort to make sure, and we stress to them, you know, it may not even be. Well, we use an example of maybe they fell off of a Humvee or something, a military vehicle. I think that's probably one. But they may have twisted their ankle. They may not realize until after they're back for several weeks that what they're experiencing is a result of that. So we try to make sure that they understand, you know, you may not initially feel, you may not be feeling the effects of that injury or something that occurred. So we try to make sure that they understand. You need to make sure you hang on to some numbers and who you get a hold of to take care of that. So, yes, we make every effort possible to make sure that we help every service member that comes back. And in hearing Director Willis's, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, testimony, I believe he has referred to and I know has said many times at the department, we assist veterans one veteran at a time. Each veteran's situation is very unique. You can't batch them and treat them all the same because they're not. So,
and do you do the same thing for those who are in reserves?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. We assist the reservists who come back and have had that active duty and are veterans as a result of that as well. Yes.
Other questions? Representative Bruin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back real quickly to the way we deliver information to the returning veterans, i.e. with this toll-free number or with the little brochure that you demonstrated. And I want to know, what was the process that got you to that point? Was it focus group work? Was it discussions with the veterans? Is this a product of on the ground research with the veterans, or is this our best guess of what we think will get into the hands and the homes of the veterans? And I'm curious because especially as legislators, we receive piles of paper this big, and we talk about the round file, and it may very well be the best method, that small brochure, but I want to know, has there been any legwork to develop that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bruin, we have done a lot of work with the family support groups and talked with. And it's really been a learning process, because when we started out with our demobilizations, we did what we took our best guess at what we thought was going to work. And it was with working with the military department, the returning service members, the members before they even were mobilized, talking with them, what's going to help you, what's going to be the best way for us to meet your needs. And that's when we came up with, they really wanted to have one thing that they could hang on to and not tons of papers or even a folder where they stick all the things in. And so, yes, it's been a kind of a work in progress with many, many participants. And I'm glad to say that the family support groups have been involved, because they let us know. And they're very vocal. They'll let you know if what you're doing is not working or if they have a very good suggestion for you. Thank you for the question.
When these men and women are about to be brought back, I believe the term was used, reintegration. That's the term for reintegration. Is there somebody over in Iraq and Afghanistan right now who is, you know, taking down names and saying, you know, what are your most critical issues over there that have show their injuries so that that document is here before they get here? And where do they come when they're brought back? Do they come directly to Oregon, or do they go to Fort Hood or Bliss or somewhere first? And are we there? I'm concerned.
Madam Chair, we actually had a meeting with the military department, the Guard, and talked about that. And what we did is we knew that there were some returning service members who would come back and would be medical holds at different places in the country. And there are individuals at the military department in leadership who make trips to visit those service members. So we try to find out, and we sit down and we say, okay, what are the things that each individual service member is facing? What is their challenge? And what information do we need to make sure we provide to them? So we actually put together individualized packets of information. We've actually had our benefits counselors here from Salem travel to the to Fort Lewis, to Madigan Hospital, to meet in person with the service members to see what their individual needs are. Prior to their departure from Iraq or Afghanistan, I don't know if there are any discussions about that. I know one of the things that a new thing that we're doing with the mobilizations is that we make sure that we talk with the service members and let them know, and they're developing a little pad that they can take with them, that, and just to let them know when something occurs, you know, take the time, if possible, to write down the date, what occurred, and get some names of some individuals who were with you at the time who can verify that that happened, because that, what that's going to do is help them with their disability claim when they do return to the states.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is just really a follow-up to Chair Nelson's question, but regarding the testimony that we heard earlier and the young man who signed a waiver, what can you tell us specifically about that? I'm hoping that what I'm going to hear is that we can make restitution in those cases.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I do know that those kinds of things occur. I know that those kinds of things actually occur with regular active duty service members as well, and I could probably use myself as an example. When I was going to exit from the military, there's a question, do you have any issues, problems that need to be addressed? Well, I had already been told from other service members, and it was pretty common knowledge, that if you say yes, it could result in an extension and they want to address that medical issue. So some people, you know, you are faced with the decision whether you're going to speak up and say that or if you're going to take the discharge. I probably did have to sign some kind of a paper that indicated that I didn't have any issues. Now, as far as restitution, I don't know the legality of the waiver. I don't know the particular waiver that the individual may have signed, but I know for myself, if I had what I believe was a service-connected injury or illness or disability, I could still file a claim for disability compensation, even though I exited the service, not indicating that I had any issues at that time. But I don't know the legalities of that particular waiver.
So follow up, Madam Chair. So are you talking about military disability when you said disability claim?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, yes, if there was an illness or injury that occurred during military service.
Could I ask you to maybe provide her with some information and the committee as well? What steps we've taken to correct that problem so that it doesn't occur with our returning troops.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions of President Comp?
Madam Chair, Director, I was wondering, many of my constituents are speaking, English is not their first language, and I was just wondering if this publication, your resource directory, is put out in any other language other than English.
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, actually we only have it produced in English at this time. Are you indicating that you actually have constituents who would need it in another
yes.
language?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could certainly do that.
Yes, they really would, and because frequently we think that everybody understands and reads English, but the statistics are quite different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could certainly do that. I don't know if we have made an indication on here that we have it available in alternate formats, but we could certainly
or
do that.
Or just even a statement, a clause that if you speak a different language, a number that maybe they can get access to information.
That's a great idea. Thank you.
We have a young man here who was in the reserves. I'm going to ask him if he'd come forward. Clinton, will you come forward, since we're just on that subject, just briefly, please. And for those who don't know, and I'm sorry, Representative Boquist is not here, but Clinton is a very good friend of Rachel, who is the legislative assistant to Representative Boquist, and he served with her, I believe.
Yes, ma'am, I did.
Afghanistan. So would you identify yourself, please?
My name is Clinton Robertson. I was deployed with the 320th Psychological Operations Company in Afghanistan.
And would you just tell us what is this issue regarding reserves extensions that you can't, when you come home, you can't identify that you have a problem because they might keep you in forever?
Well, it is rumored very well. Myself, unfortunately, I was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, from things that we had seen and done and witnessed in combat operations. But it is pretty well known that while you're at the demobilization site, you're pretty smart to just say, yeah, I'm fine, because you want to get the heck out of there and you just want to leave.
Is this site in the U.S.?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We were at Fort Bragg. We were out of combat operations for myself was for about a week or so, week or two. Went straight to Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, which is a U.S. military base, where we put all of our things together, made sure everything was clean so we could pass through customs. Shipped us to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where we went through 2 weeks of death by briefing, and we saw just about every representative for every organization that could ever offer you assistance. And most of the time, they just threw a bunch of papers at you and said, we don't really know how your Veterans Affairs works in your state, but contact them when you get there, but this is kind of the things we can offer. Here's some numbers. And then you're half awake anyway, and then they ask you the questions, you know, how do you feel? How's your health? Things like that. It is known that, you know, if you say, yeah, I have a real serious problem, you could be a medical hold. And you don't want that. You just want to get out of there. You've been gone for a year plus.
And a medical hold, excuse me, Clinton, what happens? If you were put a medical hold, what happens to you then?
What they do at that point is, depending on the extent of your injuries or what those injuries are, for example, for myself, if they would have determined that I needed to stay at the hospital there for psychological counseling, then I would stay there at the hospital or in a barrack someplace on a medical, in a medical battalion, where I would report to the hospital for the counseling sessions or whatever every single day or every other day.
Do they pay you while you were there?
Yes, ma'am. You would stay on active duty until that point. The way that it works when you return, as far as how long you stay on the payroll, basically depends on how much leave you have saved up. When you're on a one-year period, you've got 30 days of leave that you can take, your vacation. And if you take leave while you're there, like myself, my mother passed away while I was deployed. I flew home on emergency leave, was there for the funeral, returned. When they released us, I had, I think, about 13 days of leave still saved up. So when we left Fort Bragg and they released us after our 2 weeks there, I got paid for 2 more weeks, then I got my last check. And that was it. You're done. So that's where you have to, on an individual basis, you have to go out, start beating the streets, start meeting people, whatever you've got to do. Either you had a job that you can go back to, or you need to figure out what you're going to do from there on, because your last check has already come. So,
Clinton, at the moment that you, do you sign a document saying, I'm fine, I'm, you know, I signed this document and I'm done, my service is over?
Well, what they've done is, are you talking about medical, ma'am?
Mm-hmm.
Well, with what they're doing there is, at the demobilization site, they've got so many thousands of soldiers they're trying to rush through in such a hurry. I mean, they don't know your name, you're just a number, etc. They try to rush you through as quickly as possible, so you've got a quick questionnaire that says, you know, have you seen, for example, have you seen destroyed military vehicles? Have you seen fellow service members hurt or killed? Things like that. This quick questionnaire, which I'm not so sure really went anywhere because I've still got my copy, so I really never gave it to anybody. But they give you the paper, you fill it out, and it asks you, do you want a full physical at this time? We don't really have a lot of time to see everybody, but if you want one, we'll give one to you. If not, then sign here and say, hey, I don't really want a physical, let me go.
And if you don't have that physical, what happens? So if you have later, we're worried about mental problems.
Right.
If you don't, are like we've just heard, you might have injured a leg that, you know, manifests, the problem manifests later.
Right. I think what was communicated to us was that if you did have a problem, if you didn't go through the complete physical, when you got home, you could get with your individual state representatives for the Veterans Affairs and try and get yourself in for a physical, provided the Veterans Affairs hospital had time to get you in. Dental, for example, forget. We were told that straight up at Fort Bragg. On the DD-214, which for the record is a certificate of release or discharge from active duty service, on that DD-214 form, towards the bottom, there is a block that says the service member was or was not or did or did not receive a completion of all dental services provided at the time of release. So, like for us, they didn't have time. There were so many thousand soldiers, they couldn't get us in. So at the bottom of all of our forms, it says, no, all dental work was not completed prior to release of active duty. So we were told when we get back, try and get in with your VA. Medical, you've got a good shot of getting into the VA hospital. But dental, forget it. You may as well get a job, get a civilian dental care, because you'll never see them.
Even though you're entitled.
That's correct. They told us that straight up before Bragg. You will never see the dental at the Veterans Hospital. They have so many thousands of people to see, and you're just, unless you're bleeding and one tooth is broken and you're in such pain, they're not going to look at you.
We previously had the head of the Veterans Hospital here, and we were told that if necessary, they can give you a voucher and you can access local medical care. Have you ever attempted to get that voucher?
I have not, ma'am.
Paula, would you...
I didn't know that that was an option, honestly.
Would you mind to look into this and see if we're so maxed out at the Veterans Hospital that we cannot afford these men and women the care to which they're entitled, could you let us know how many vouchers they signed and how many individuals they are allowing to access medical care? Otherwise, what is allowed by law, as I understand, we'll get Dr. Berger up here and ask him, is apparently not being done the way I hear it now, but let's check on it and give them certainly the benefit of a doubt.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to do that, and if I might, I'll take just a moment. I actually know Clinton. I didn't know that he was going to be here today, and I could say that he's probably a fine example of exactly what a service member should do upon their return. I got a phone call from Clinton, and actually I had a meeting with him, and we sat down to strategize about what different benefits may be available to him, and then got him in contact with those people. In fact, we went downstairs and he met with our veteran services manager to make sure that he got the benefits to which he was entitled. So he was a fine example of making sure that you do follow up with your Oregon department or your local Department of Veterans Affairs to get the benefits.
Right. And unfortunately, a lot of soldiers don't do that because they don't know. And they also don't understand what they're doing. And their families are kind of distraught at times because they don't really know what's going on. In reference to Representative Comp's question that she had for Ms. Brown, on the languages, you have service members that have married overseas all over the place, and you have every single ethnic background and different languages that are spoken in every single different home for service members, and their families are oftentimes the ones that need the help the most. And a service member comes back and says, well, I mean, we've been gone for a year plus. The phone doesn't ring, the dog doesn't bark, the kids don't scream. You don't have any problems. But when you get back and your family's got this mound of problems, and they are asking a lot of the same questions.
I appreciate that. Okay, Representative Farr.
Clinton, I wondered if you would mind giving us a copy of the survey that you filled out.
Certainly.
That would be helpful, and then we can contact our congressional delegation regarding.
No problem. What they gave me from Fort Bragg, they looked at that form, and the doctor that was there said, okay, I see, great. Do you want to be a medical holder or not? I said, no, I don't. I want to go home. I have a wife and children. And he said, okay, no problem. Make sure you follow up with somebody when you get back. You know, make a phone call or whatever when you get there. Go talk to somebody. But stamp the paperwork good, and then just handed me all the paperwork and said, bring this in if you ever have a problem to the VA hospital. So I've got all the copies of everything. They never went in the files. So.
Paula, is there a concern with our returning soldiers, if they speak up, they get demoted, get kicked out. I mean, is there fear there, and what do we do about it? if there is?
Madam Chair, I don't know if there's any fear on the part of the service members. I think primarily it comes out of their motivation to reunite with their families as quickly as possible. One of the things that we do talk with them at the demo, because we realize they want to do that, is to let them know, you know, you really do need to think about it, because while you want to reunite with your family quickly now, and we certainly understand that, it really is an impact to your family and your family's financial future to think about these kinds of things. So I don't know if there's any fear on the part. I can't imagine that there would be for demotion. I don't think that they could possibly do that kind of a thing. There may be service members who aren't aware of that, but I think primarily their motivation is reuniting with their families.
It is.
Any other questions? Thank you so much, Clinton.
Thank you.
And you're a fine young man. Appreciate your coming forward. I want to ask Mr. Cluding to come forward, if you would, please. If you just identify yourself, Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nelson and committee. My name is Bill Cluding. I represent Western Council Industrial Workers in this state. Some of my members and some of my members' family are involved in this this war. Listening to all the problems that have popped up, I think we need to take a long look at the situation of a group that's not talked about very much, the ones that are in Walter Reed, the ones that will be coming home on stretchers. The generation of military we have now, we're not expecting this avalanche of problems that they hear every day. My question is our veterans and our military and our Oregon National Guard prepared to accept the members that are coming home minus limbs, that this will involve the rest of their life? Somehow there has to be a program ready to where these people that gave almost their all, that there is never a problem down the road when it comes to, if some of these people, it would be a life-threatening the rest of their life. But somehow a program has to be in place ready to where nobody has to wait on a limb. Nobody has to wait for a form to be filled out. That's my question. And I want to thank this committee for the very thorough progress that you're making on these problems. Thank you.
Well, I certainly want to thank you for caring about your men and women, and thank you for coming forward.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. At this time, I'm going to call on Dr. Berger. Dr. Leslie Berger, if you please come forward. And thank you very much for allowing us to hear those in the audience today. I'm amazed. I think that probably even gives you input of many of the concerns that we have for our system as you talk about our benefit package we have.
Very definitely, Madam Chairperson, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity, allowing me the opportunity to chat with you. Perhaps just a word of introduction about me. My name is Les Berger. I'm a physician. I joined the Veterans Department, Federal Department of Veterans Administration, in 1999, and prior to that, I served for 33 years on active duty with the Army, and my last assignment was as the commanding general at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And on a personal note, I have three sons. One is presently in Afghanistan. One who's been in the Guard for the last 20 years is getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan. So the care of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, their families, active reserve component, past and present, is something that's very, very important to me. I have prepared for you all a series of slides that you each have, and a copy of an MOU that I'll make a comment about in a bit, and an article about a program that I'd like to address. Before I begin, Madam Chairperson, though, let me please address the folks from the Coalition for Troop Support. Under current law that the just prior Secretary Principe had put in place. Any service member who has served honorably in theater, all that individual needs to do is to show up at a VA, Veterans Administration, Veterans Health Administration facility and identify themselves as having served. And that individual is entitled to care, 2 years of care.
And so
it is clear that that word needs to get out. I've given both folks my card, and I'll get in touch with them and make sure that that happens. So they are entitled to care. And indeed, the comment that was made by Clinton about the dental issue is a very real issue for us, and I can comment on that as well. It really does, listening to the testimony, highlight the need for much better coordination and cooperation about all the entities that are trying to provide care. Health resources are scarce enough in our country, and certainly here in the Northwest, that we don't want to be duplicating things, but rather complementing each other so that we can all work together. I hope that I could take the opportunity to spend a few minutes kind of talking about the federal Department of Veterans Affairs and how we go about providing care, and then get into specific issues about OIF. I'm going to owe a lot when I...
Oh, I was so happy to hear you say that. We are very fun.
Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. So let me do that first and get to you. On the second slide, it points out that the Veterans Health Administration is a regionalized health system. We're divided into today 22 regions. The concept being to decentralize and regionalize provision of health services. The next slide looks at us in Vision 20, the Northwest Network. And you can see that we are the states of Alaska, Washington, Oregon and Idaho, and actually a couple of counties in Northern California and Montana as well. Within the state of Oregon, there are three major facilities that I know you're familiar with: the highly complex tertiary care facility, the Portland Veterans Administration Medical Center, that has a strong affiliation with the Oregon Health and Science University. A smaller facility in Roseburg, Oregon, and the nation's largest freestanding rehabilitation center in White City, Oregon, the Southern Oregon Rehabilitation Center. In addition, there are several community-based outpatient clinics operated by these three facilities. We call those CBOX, community-based outpatient clinics, that are physically, geographically separate from their parent facility. Those clinics are located, as you can see, well, it not see so well on the map, in Klamath Falls, Bandon, Brookings, North Coast at Camp Rylea, Eugene, Salem, and Bend. So it's a fairly extensive system. The vet centers, the regional counseling centers, of which there are four in Oregon, are actually not part of the Veterans Health Administration, but of course we work very closely with them. But they are not part of the region that I am the director of.
Dr. Berger, would you give us those again? Klamath Falls, Bandon, Eugene, Salem.
Klamath Falls, Bandon, Brookings, Camp Rylea up on the North Coast. There's a clinic there on that facility. Eugene, Salem, and Bend. And actually, there's
and
a very...
you call those...
Sorry?
You call those...
CBOCs, Community-Based Outpatient Clinics. Now, the next slide just highlights for you the referral pattern. We need to emphasize that we have a regionalized integrated hub-and-spoke system. So Portland, actually within the state of Oregon, Roseburg is a referral center for the rehabilitation center in White City, and then all the highly complex and tertiary care kind of things, like a major orthopedic surgery or heart surgery and that kind of thing, get referred to Portland. So this is, and there's a lot of interaction between the Seattle facility and the Portland, which are our two tertiary facilities. There's a lot of crossover there. Portland provides both organ transplantation, both renal and kidney renal and liver transplantation, and so they are a referral pattern really for the western part of the United States. And the same is really true of the Rehabilitation Center in White City. They take patients, veterans from all across the United States, primarily on the West Coast. Okay.
And VISN is Veterans Integrated Service Network?
Vision is Veterans Integrated Service Network. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Jim.
The next slide that says welcome, it just points out to you, our budget this year exceeds $1 billion, 60% of which is salaries for our more than 8,300 full-time employees. We have hundreds more who are volunteers and contract personnel who are part of our network family. And I mentioned to you that the Portland Medical Center has a strong affiliation with OHSU, as does the Seattle facility with the University of Washington. There are approximately 125 or 130 young physicians in training at the Portland facility, as well as dozens of other health professionals. We have over 90 affiliations with schools across the Northwest in nursing and pharmacy and in administration and a lot of other areas. On the next slide, I just point out that our mission is fourfold. Our primary mission is that of providing health care to veterans. In support of that mission, we have a very robust graduate education program, health education program, and an outstanding medical research program. As a matter of fact, Portland ranks among the top medical centers in the country in research. It is a superb program. Our fourth mission is to support our communities and the military in case of man-made or natural disasters. And under the National Defense Medical System, NDMS, we provide beds to the Department of Defense in times of emergency. We have exercises on a regular basis and report our bid capability to house military service members if we need to.
May I just ask you, Dr. Berger, here in the state of Oregon, it's my understanding we have 370,000 veterans, and I see this system says we only serve 195,000.
That is correct.
Is that in the whole region?
Yes, ma'am. We have about 1.1 million veterans who are living in our four-state area, and our market share is about 17 or 18%. So we are currently serving about 200,000 veterans of the 1.1 million. That is true.
Thank you.
The next slide presents the veterans that we serve, gives you some demographics about about 80% of our veterans are either have service-connected disability or are catastrophically disabled, such as spinal cord injured or blinded, are indigent, needing health care that they cannot obtain in other ways. So the vast majority of our patients are in those categories of service connection.
80% of the 1.1 million or 80%
of the 200,000. Yeah, 80% of the 200,000.
80% of those have.
They're either service connected or have a catastrophic illness or injury, or are indigent and have no other means of getting health care. Interestingly, if you look across the system, we are actually the youngest, in quotes, network, in that only 40% of our patients, our veterans, are over 65, which means that over the next decade or so, we are going to experience a huge number of veterans who require care that older individuals in our country require, the specialty care, long-term care, and those kind of things, and we are trying to address that. The next slide just briefly tells you about our employees. We have an excellent record as an employer. We have a diverse and a very accomplished workforce. I'd note to you that our workforce, as it is across the federal system, is aging and facing significant challenges in recruiting and retaining folks with the expertise to care for veterans. In that regard, Portland, again, the medical center is working with the state in addressing nursing issues, for example, of how to work together to train nurses who would then hopefully stay within the federal sector. The next slide briefly points out what our budget is within the state. About $423 million in medical care funds. That includes about $228 million for about 3,400 full-time employees in the state. And again, our very robust research program, about $27-plus million, primarily at the Portland facility.
Do you plan to get into where this 423 comes from? Like, would we know if that's from Medicaid or from veterans?
No, this is appropriated dollars from the federal government part of our budget.
Veterans?
Yes, ma'am. The Department of Veterans Affairs at the national level has a budget that is in the $60-plus billion. About $30 billion of that is part of the Veterans Health Administration. And our share of that $30 billion in our network is about $1 billion. Okay.
For the four states?
Yes, ma'am. In caring for our 200,000 veterans. So we're expending about $5,000 per veteran, if you kind of look at it in that sense. The next three, just for your information, just presents to you a little information about each of the three medical centers and what they do and which of those outpatient clinics is part of their system. I would point out to you that in Portland, we are hopeful to be able to open in the next year or two of the community-based clinics in the metropolitan Portland area, the intent being to really decompress a very crowded situation on the Portland campus, parking and otherwise, so that we could expand specialty services, again, as part of that hub-and-spoke system.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Hunt.
Thank you. A question specifically about that. Where do those two additional sites stand in the selection process? Do you have a specific site for either or both in mind?
The Metro West Clinic, actually, we are negotiating a lease. I can't give you the exact location, but we have a building with about 20,000 square feet, and we're hopeful to finalize that lease and be moved in this fiscal year. The Metro East Clinic in Portland, no site has been identified, nor have our funds been identified for that one. So I do hope we will move into the Metro West, and they anticipate perhaps 15,000 veterans seeking their primary care at that site, which would be very good for the veterans and for us.
If I can follow up on that, as you define Metro East, how wide of a geographic area are you open to looking at?
It's the metropolitan, really the metropolitan area in Portland itself is where they're looking.
In the city of Portland, or?
I think they're looking further than the city of Portland, but I don't. Jim Tuschmidt has the information about that. Under the Southern Oregon, the Rehabilitation Center in White City, I would just comment that, again, that is the largest freestanding rehabilitation center in the country. They have over 700 operating beds. They have a census of over 500 veterans. They provide a very extensive rehabilitation, biopsychosocial rehabilitation program, which is nationally acclaimed in helping to rehabilitate veterans. It is truly a model.
I'm going to say General Berger now that I know.
Dr. Berger,
okay,
less is fine, ma'am.
Does this facility take veterans from other states beyond our four that are in our territory?
Yes, ma'am, it does.
It does.
The majority come from the Northwest and Northern California and Nevada.
Do Northwest veterans get a priority, or?
They do.
Okay.
They do. But they will take veterans from anywhere in the country, and they do. They have a substantial number of people from outside the country, the four states. Under Roseburg, I would only comment that they, too, have a nursing home there as well as Portland. The NHCU is Nursing Home Care Unit, so they do operate a unit that actually opened in the last 3 or 4 years. It's a beautiful unit. The next slide I would just point out and highlight for you, that shows a graph of dating back from July of 2002. It is our goal and the goal of VHA that every veteran has the medical appointment he or she needs, both in primary and specialty care, within 30 days of that request. 2.5 years ago, we had over 31,000 veterans in our network waiting for an appointment.
I wanted to speak to that because I know that issue. I had individuals speak in our committee who had plastic prosthesis that waiting 2 years just to get a doctor name for them, not an appointment,
yes,
6 months later to get an appointment,
mm-hmm.
and maybe 2 years later to get a new prosthesis.
That
and so this is greatly improved.
Well, this speaks to the primary care piece, and we did over the last 2 years, it became our strategic plan to provide that primary care for all the veterans. And as you can see, as of last May, we were down to under 500 patients. That list today is about 1,000 patients. The facilities in Portland and at White City have grown in double digits. In Roseburg, more modestly, and that continued demand for health care is stressing our ability to provide that care from a resource perspective, and we all share that concern.
Are you funded appropriately now?
We are funded, ma'am, based on workload. It's a workload-based based system. The current secretary and the administration has made it clear that we will give priority to our newest veterans and those veterans who have service-connected conditions, and we are doing everything possible to realign our resources to meet the needs of those veterans.
And Dr. Berger, is there a discrepancy or difference between our Oregon Guard or reservists and other military servicemen and women?
Well, you heard testimony about that this morning. That distresses me. I can tell you from a medic's perspective, that's not an issue. It has never been an issue.
Thank you.
A soldier, sailor, airman, marine is a soldier, sailor, airman, marine, and if someone has a broken arm, it's a broken arm. It's not a reservist broken arm.
It
is true.
Where are you located?
I'm sorry?
Where are you located?
Actually in Vancouver. Yeah, right. Our office is in Vancouver. On that's part of the campus of the Portland facility, actually.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that. There are indeed different issues related to the reserve component and the active component. And one of the thoughts I had, I'll say it now, having someone from the Guard actually at the major demobilization site, I don't know the numbers specifically, but I would imagine the majority of the folks coming home to the state of Oregon are going to come through Fort Lewis. Now, I may be wrong about that. If that were the case, having a liaison person would be something very worthwhile to do. From a VA perspective, we do have people both from the Veterans Health Administration and the Veterans Benefits Administration that are actually stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, and you've heard Clinton speak to death by briefing was his term, which is very true, and it is really not the right venue, in my experience, when people are just returning from being away for well over a year. And from Fort Lewis, Washington, you could almost see Oregon, and you really want to get home, that you're really not paying attention to a lot of things. And being able to communicate that information from what Mr. Brown talked about, whether it's brochures or 800 numbers or reaching out to the actual armory, guard unit, and reserve center is really the way to do that, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Again, the next slide, again, I just wanted to highlight for you what this displays is actually the 21 networks by bar graph by how much they grew in the last year. And we envision 20 are on the far left. We were at the top. We grew over 6%, almost double what the VHA average has been. And again, that is a concern. And this year,
and the reason for that, excuse me, and the reason we've grown so much.
Well, in my opinion, the reason is and continues to be. By the way, we're growing at about 7% through the first quarter of this fiscal year. The federal fiscal year ends the 30th of September. So through the first quarter of this fiscal year, we've already grown. You know well. We've had issues of fiscal issues within the states in Washington, Oregon, Alaska. We've had terrible unemployment issues within states. And as a matter of fact, I saw a statistic not too long ago where Alaska, Washington, and Oregon had the highest unemployment in the nation for many, many months. You do know that there have been many health maintenance organizations that have had difficulty and have discontinued care for patients, many of whom, if they were veterans, have come to the veterans for care. So there are a lot of reasons why our numbers continue to grow, and we don't see an end in sight. And again, that's a concern because of the cost of providing care to the 200,000 veterans.
Is there any concern, because it's my understanding that the federal government has never fully funded disability permanently?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, ma'am. I'm not sure exactly what it is you're speaking to.
Well, our concern is, you know, will there be funds available because there is no permanent appropriation?
You mean to have entitlement as opposed to, and well, that's really not for me to, you know,
but
to answer.
When
Clinton and Mr. Brown both made reference to the fact that if a service member leaves the military, be it active or reserve component, and then feels that they have a medical issue, there is a process whereby that individual applies, makes a claim to the Department of Veterans Affairs. That process can take some time to have that fully adjudicated, and then that individual, based on that determination, if that individual has a service-connected issue, medical care is provided for that issue. Okay, entirely.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
The next slide just mentions the numbers of veterans treated, and it shows you by facility. So you could see the Southern Oregon Rehab Center, the number of its patients, Roseburg at 23,000 and Portland at 51,000. So there's about close to 100,000 patients or 90,000 patients of our total that are being served in Oregon. And you can see that our numbers have grown by 65% in the last 7 years. Again, unprecedented growth for us, and it mentions our market share of about 16.5%.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Bruin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Please.
On that slide that you're referring to right now, you show the various facilities, including the Washington facilities. One of the ones I'm interested in is the Walla Walla facility. Yeah. I've heard rumor that it may be scheduled to close, and that's a particular interest, even though it's in Washington, a particular interest to our veterans in the northeast part of the state. Can you talk to that rumor?
I certainly can. 2 to 3 years ago now, the Department of Veterans Affairs undertook a process called CARES, Capital Asset Realignment for Enhanced Services, CARES. That has been a very long, there's been a CARES commission formally appointed that visited many places around the country for realignment or closure. Walla Walla was one of those facilities that was considered. The secretary in May of this past year made a decision that there was not enough information to make any decisions about the future of health care and how that was to be delivered in Walla Walla. And so a study has been declared necessary. A contract has been let at the federal level, and that is now ongoing, and it will probably be the rest of this year, calendar year, probably next January, before we have an answer about that. We are very much in a part of that. There is a local advisory panel that is representative of all the significant stakeholders in the Walla Walla area, which, as you know, serves a 10-county area, including the northeastern part of Oregon. And there are members on that panel from Oregon, I believe, that represent both Native American, American Indian, and all the other interests in the area. So we won't know for a while. The Secretary is committed that health care services are to be enhanced and not decremented.
Okay.
So no one is proposing at all, because I know this was one of the issues that came up, that people would expect veterans to travel from Walla Walla 3 hours to Spokane for care. That has never been part of the consideration. So it is a terribly underserved area, as you know, from a healthcare perspective, and we have patients that come to Walla Walla not only from Idaho but from Montana. So we are working hard to figure out how best to provide services in that area.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Please.
Do you have a better idea of when this study will be completed?
In January
of 06.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And then upon the completion of that study, based on its recommendation, who makes the final decision?
The Secretary of the Department of Affairs, Veterans
Affairs.
The Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Veterans Affairs, right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, this is his commission. He will make that decision. He has already gotten the Congress. There's been probably $1 billion already allocated to construction and other ways of enhancing care for people. And this is a many, many year process.
Right.
That's well known.
Thank you very much.
Fine. Can I please skip over, there are some slides here that speak to patient satisfaction, employee satisfaction, our clinical performance, and let me spend the next few minutes addressing OIF, OEF, if I may use that acronym. I was actually surprised to learn that since the onset of hostilities in Afghanistan and Iraq, there have been over 1 million service members deployed to theater, 1 million. As of December, there have been 258,000 service members who have either separated from the military or their reserve or guard unit has been deactivated. There have been about 10,000 of those individuals who are from the Northwest, and I do not have the specific numbers for Oregon. I couldn't get them, but we can get them. I believe they're by zip code, so I think we could get them. And I would also point out to you that our Northwest network, our Northwest area, is very well represented. Not only has the brigade and other units that you know about from Oregon been deployed, the same is true for the Washington Guard and Reserve. The Idaho Guard is now in country and is due back now in about a year, probably in December or January. There have been two active duty brigades deployed out of Fort Lewis, Washington, and a third brigade from Alaska is now in training at Fort Lewis for deployment. So we've had our share of deploying service members. So this is a very important issue for us. The next one speaks to, of the 258,000 people who have come back, about 16% of them thus far have sought care from the Veterans Health Administration. And listed there for you are the top five diagnoses, if I can call it that. And the percentages in each of those ranges from about 19 to 25%. Musculoskeletal is actually at the top of the list. The vast majority of people who are coming back complaining of issues related to musculoskeletal system. Mental health... I'm just going to say the mental health number is about 19%.
So there is parity for mental health treatment. There is parity for mental health treatment for our soldiers with musculoskeletal and so forth?
Yes.
I've had a concern for that.
Well, let me address that, Madam Chairman, because there are issues for us. Within Vision 20, we have seen so far about 1,400 folks come to our facilities, and about 500 of those in the state of Oregon. I would also say that I know testimony about catastrophically disabled people. There have been 203. Thankfully, it's a small number, but never small enough. 203 who have had amputation. and about 36 or so who have been blinded.
36, did you say?
Yes, ma'am. I believe you heard the evacuation. For those people who are identified in country that have an illness or injury, those individuals are often evacuated from in country through Landstuhl, Germany, where there's a military medical center, back to Walter Reed or Bethesda or Fort Bragg or wherever there is a large medical facility and a mobilization demobilization site. Then back for many of our soldiers, primarily soldiers who are returning, would come through Fort Lewis and then back home. About half of the people that we have seen of those 1,400 are soldiers who have just walked in. They've just walked into the clinic at Klamath Falls or in Bend and said, I'm an OIF or an OIF veteran, I have an issue, and we are taking care of those individuals and then doing all the paperwork.
And
you know, where
how
is your
many
DD?
Is that?
I'm sorry?
How many?
I'd say about half of the 1,400 who have just walked into our facilities and said they have an issue. Let me also describe for you that at Madigan Army Medical Center at Fort Lewis, we have assigned two full-time social workers who are meeting and greeting the service members and their families to make sure, I mean, they're really functioning as case managers to make sure that we're meeting the needs of those individuals. And I would add, Madam Chairperson, that the concern as expressed here is far more for those individuals who have not identified, who we have not identified as having an issue. Because those individuals go back home, and then an issue surfaces, and we are looking for ways, as you've heard, to reach out to the families and the service members to make sure they know where to go for the help that they need. Now let me address in the next the several programs, because I do think that's really important. That's really the crux of this, and that is I've mentioned to you the demobilization process, and you've heard firsthand what that process is like, because there are indeed at times hundreds of people who are demobilizing at the same time. And for those people who are active component, where they live and work on a military installation, that support structure is all there. It is for those individuals who demobilize and then return to the community, where we need to be working through the Reserve Center and the Guard Armories. And in fact, each of our facilities has designated a nurse and or social worker who visits the armories and reserve centers, attends the family support briefings, and is trying very hard to reach out to make sure that service members are aware of what benefits are available from a health perspective.
Is there an 800 number?
Yes, ma'am. There is.
Thank you.
Could we know what it is?
I do not have it, but I will get it for you.
Thank you so much.
So I mentioned to you the demobilization process and the outreach efforts. Let me also mention a DOD survey, Department of Defense survey, that's being done. Again, you heard about that. That actually happens to people as they come out of the field and are getting ready to return home. A form is filled out. And just recently, Dr. Winkenwerter, who is the Assistant Secretary of Defense Health Affairs, has mandated that every returning service member within 90 days or so will return and complete a survey that is designed to get at health issues.
Great.
There are some issues with that, however, issues of confidentiality.
Sure.
And issues that you've heard expressed, and actually in one of the slides will demonstrate that many members, service members, are hesitant for lots of different reasons to come forward with issues that they may have. So we need to continue to work at that. And I must say I have met with Jim Willis and Paula Brown. We've talked about how we can collaborate and work together to make sure that we're getting the word out to folks about what services are available. just last evening having dinner with a Portland school teacher who was raising the issue about children experiencing problems with returning parents.
Yeah.
That is another venue for us perhaps to educate school teachers about what things that they could be looking out for so they can come forward and let folks know so we can reach out to the parents with those 800 numbers. They're already experiencing in some children the results of family difficulties when a service member returns home. So it's yet another way of reaching out. I provided you all with a copy of an MOU, which I thought was really a neat idea, and I thought I would share with you. Again, as I had mentioned to you, that it is so important that we not duplicate, but rather work together to complement. In Washington State, Jim Willis's counterpart there, John King, assembled a group of people that included the Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs, the Federal Veterans Health Administration, Veterans Benefits Administration, the U.S. Department of Labor, the Washington State Military Department, the Washington State Employment Security Department, and the Governor's Veterans Advisory Council, and the Association of Washington Businesses, brought all these people together to sign a memorandum of understanding that whose purpose is to make sure that they partner and integrate services. I thought that was a wonderful idea, and that concept is something that I hope we could disseminate around our system. I gave you an article about a community-based healthcare initiative, and I think you again heard Clinton. I'm sorry, I missed Clinton's last name with my hearing. So
Robertson.
Please, I'm sorry.
Robertson.
So please forgive me.
We appreciated him testifying.
I've been referring to as Clinton rather than Mr. Robertson because I, with my hearing aid, I didn't catch your last name.
Okay.
So Mr. Robertson made reference to. There is now an initiative, and I would really hope that we can work very hard to make this happen in our network for those injured people. Individuals who wind up primarily at the Walter Reed and Bethesda National Naval Medical Center, to bring those folks home to Madigan Army Medical Center, to the Portland VA Medical Center. We can provide that care for them here. Those individuals don't need to be sitting at Walter Reed with a broken leg for 3 months. We can provide that care here where their support structures are. So I'm very anxious to work with you all to make sure that happens.
That's
and
great.
Dr. Tuschmidt and his counterparts are very well aware of this program. We're working very hard to make that happen. And let me mention homelessness. There's no question that the risk for homelessness is great among our returning service members, and I learned not too long ago that actually among our women veterans, it's even fourfold what it is our men veterans returning for lots of different reasons. We need to be aware of that, and we need to be doing that risk assessment really up front so that we get a handle on the business of employment and so on so that we can put some preventive measures in place as quickly as we can. And finally, the issue of what's called here DS3 in the Army, that's the Disabled Soldier Support System. And I understand the Marines have now stood up a similar program. They both have a website that I didn't record for you all, but you can get through the Army or the Marine Corps website. Its purpose, again, is to identify individuals that have need and, again, to reach out to those individuals, even with an ombudsman, to provide that support for those individuals. I really like the concept of an ombudsman in the Marine. The U.S. Marine Corps system, if I remember it correctly, it's looking to get a fairly senior retiree who understands the system, who is a little more mature, has been around a little longer, who could then help that service member work his or her way through the bureaucracies to get the service. And that's something else that we really need to work for. Hopefully, the numbers of such people will be small. But as those folks come back to us, come back home, we need to have someone that could be their spokesperson in that sense. So as you can see, Madam Chairperson, there's a plethora of programs designed to assist service members and families. There is much, much more that needs to be done. And this is why I began my comments with a plea that we try to work together so as not to duplicate services, rather to complement each other's programs. I truly believe that Oregon's Department of Veterans Affairs is really in the best position to coordinate these activities within the state, because as you know, number one, there is no active duty military facility here in Oregon, and the majority of service members returning to Oregon are reserve component soldiers. With that, let me stop and ask, one more, please. Let me say something specifically about post-traumatic stress disorder. This actually was taken from the front page of USA Today back in I think the end of last year. It's a report on a study that was published out of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, in which about 5,000 returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq were given a survey about mental health. I would caution about extrapolating these results to the entire million people who have been deployed. These are specific combat infantrymen who were given this survey. But in essence, some 15% overall of those individuals experienced symptoms of anxiety, depression, and/or PTSD. And as you can see on the right side there, soldiers were asked, and Marines, you know, would you tell us if you're having symptoms or not? And you can see the results. And again, I think the testimony you heard today really substantiates. Well, there are a lot of reasons.
What can we do about that?
Well, I think for the most part, there are several things we can do. One is we have to desensitize so that the concept of saying, yes, I'm having some issues related to my service in country is not a bad thing. My personal belief, Madam Chairperson, is that no one goes into a theater of combat without being changed. So the assumption is that everyone that comes home has been changed. And we need to figure out which of those folks needs to spend 10 minutes with a counselor or needs no more than to be home with their loved ones, and which of those people need short-term care and which people need prolonged care. I believe we are proving yet again, and we seem to in each major conflict our nation finds itself, that identifying individuals as soon as possible and treating them as soon as possible stands the greatest chance of returning that individual to the fullest quality of life and full health. And I know that the military actually has assigned mental health providers with units. I don't know if you had within your unit. The concept being to serve as that individual, to work with soldiers right then. To do that decompression and work through the issues, which we have found over again our history that again saves that chronicity of those kinds of issues. So thank you for the opportunity to share. And as I mentioned, I would be delighted at some point if you would like to focus specifically on mental health to bring a group of folks together, including the Department of Defense, the folks that are at Madigan Army Medical Center, at the vet centers, and so on, to come and speak with you. We've been very proactive. We actually hosted a summit in Vancouver, Washington, and brought all the players together to kind of do a needs assessment. We actually put a map on the wall and looked at where all our resources were, local, state, federal, and how we were going to go about that. In fact, that group just met in follow-up just recently. And so I think we are putting our foot forward in trying to reach out for folks that have mental health issues. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Dr. Berger, I am personally so overcome by your concern for our veterans. I don't even know what to say, but I'm so grateful, and
I just, you know, think we need to clone you, you know, millions of times. And for you to take the time from your busy schedule, but, you know, I just think you have so much to teach so many. And I wish I could put you on every major TV station for an hour. In fact, I'm going to work on that. have a documentary, because people need to hear what we just heard. And we recently asked TRICARE, who came out with a brand new plan, after, and we heard about it, after our 3670th had headed to Texas, Brian? And here we heard, here's a new medical plan. You can have 90 days dental care, your whole family. Well, my goodness, they didn't get their orders 90 days in advance, number one. And, you know, they're gone, you know, for their 2 months of preparation here. And those individuals didn't know about it. I felt so bad. And, you know, sometimes we just, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So, you know, we're working very hard to catch up with them now. And thanks to General Byrne and Colonel Caldwell and that whole team of letting them know that there's this whole new package. And they deserve it. And because they are our guard and have been treated differently, I think it's so important what you've said. You know, and just like Director Willis, you know, every veteran's important, every serviceman or woman, and, you know, every day's Veterans Day. And we're all, they all deserve the highest respect and service. I'll ask other questions. Rep. Z. Hunt.
You've got a PR agent in our chair.
There you go.
She's going to be your emissary to the whole to the media well, country.
It's very near and dear to my heart.
I'm fascinated by the this memorandum of understanding that talks about not only the VA medical centers and the VA readjustment counseling service vet centers, but these 29 PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, sites around the state of Washington. Can you tell us how those are funded, what the lessons have been from that, and if that's a model for us as well?
Only very generally, I would refer you to Ms. Brown and Mr. Willis to talk to their counterparts. My understanding is that the state actually pays for those individuals to provide care, and that's what I was referring to about trying to literally do a gap analysis and lay this out across the state to see where all the care is, so we're not duplicating things, but try to work with each other to figure out how we cover the waterfront to provide those services to people.
Representative Hunt, would you please repeat that question?
Within the memorandum of understanding, basically on the last page of that, it outlines this, the Washington Department of Veterans Affairs outpatient program for post-traumatic stress disorder. It's on the bottom half of that last page of the memorandum. And it talks about there being 29 sites across the state of Washington that specifically provide those services. And sounds like a great...
I believe those are individuals. Those are individual practitioners who have been contracted by the state to provide those services. And I don't know how they're doing, whether it's on fee or I don't know how they're actually doing that.
I wonder, Madam Chair, if we might be able to request. You're already writing down. Thank you, ma'am.
Absolutely.
As you well know, particularly when it comes to post-traumatic stress, depression, anxiety, really are the three major diagnoses that service members express when they do come home. You know that those symptoms can manifest themselves in weeks and months, and so that is the issue, to continually reach out to make sure that the service members, but as importantly the families, are aware. So when issues arise, they indeed have an 800 number, and they know where to go to get those services.
I guess we could ask Director Willis or Paula, but you know, I'm concerned. It seems like the state of Oregon is so remiss in funding our programs for our veterans, and here's kind of an example, and this may be, you know, private enterprise stepping in to fill a function, but.
Well, I,
Are our budgets comparable in this four-state region we're part of?
You're not going to get me to answer
that. I'm not going to let you answer.
Madam Chairperson.
Oh, darn.
But please realize, though, Washington State has 676,000 veterans. They have many, many active-duty military bases. You know, Bremerton and Everett and Bangor and Fort Lewis and the Air Force at McChord and in Fairchild. So this is very much, in fact, when I served at Fort Lewis, the community had a very active lobby. They went back to Washington, D.C. every year to make it very clear how much money was being spent within the community, you know, within the state. And so there was a very active lobby there. And that's part of it. It's all very important.
Could you tell us if the Department of Defense has funds like this TRICARE group who were here? And do they have funds to, I said, why don't you put it on television? You know, how do we reach, you know?
Well, TRICARE, let me make just a very brief comment about TRICARE. This has been ongoing for over 10 years. It's a way that the Department of Defense now uses a contractor to provide services in addition to the services that are provided by the military medical facilities. That program has grown tremendously over the last 10 years, and just this past year, that contract was renegotiated, and there are now only three contractors in the country. Our contractor in the western part of the United States is a company called TriWest. They're housed or headquartered out of Phoenix. They have offices in San Diego and up in, actually, at Fort Lewis area. They're folks to, you know, to talk to about some of this issue. They are challenged, particularly in Oregon, again, because without a lot of active duty people in the state of Oregon, trying to establish their network has been an issue for them. But I could get you their name. You have their, and I would contact them. And,
yes, and you know, I was just. It seems like the communication is the key.
Yes.
And somehow it seems like there needs to be funding, you know, in our programs. Like right now, I'm going to do a program for you. With you, and I want you to speak to this and our veterans and our guard and our associations, because you know, if we don't know, how can we help individuals? So I was just believing that the DOD really needs to somehow get out more information, especially as these programs change, like this one that just came about.
Yeah.
So, Representative Boquist.
Yeah, if I could, this is more of a comment. First of all, Dr. Berger, thank you for your excellent testimony, and I want to thank you for at least finishing your formal testimony with the point about post-traumatic stress disorder, and how we need to break any stigmas involved with that. In my opinion, and we were discussing it up here, if you're in a combat zone, something's wrong with you if you don't have some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think it's what differentiates the United States Armed Forces, the best in the world, from some of the other nations that aren't quite as high quality as our imports of our nation. We are human, and we always remain human, and that's something that we want to continue to reach out for and enhance, and never to brush away or to deny or to step aside from it. So my hat's off to you for working to break down those barriers and keep our armed forces human.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate that comment.
I would like to ask. So get Dr. Berger off the hook. I would like to ask Paula Brown to please supply us with the amount of funding of the other three states in our region, if you will, please. And I'd like to know how much is, you know, available per soldier. You know, we have this information where our soldiers in the state of Oregon receive anywhere from $115 to $700, I believe, or $500 less per person than other states, and so it's really hard for me to understand how that would be the case if we're all veterans, we're all in it together. How could we get such a discrimination?
In watching CNN during some of the debates, The new senator from Illinois raised that issue at the hearing, confirmation hearing of the new secretary for the Department of Veterans Affairs about soldiers returning to the state of Illinois. Apparently, had that same issue, and the secretary was taken aback. The secretary designee at that point was taken aback by that. I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's certainly worth. I'm getting all kinds of people involved here. Jerry Luong needs to look at that issue. He's the regional director for the Veterans Benefits Administration in Portland, and again, we work very closely. And I don't know why that would be.
Are there any other questions of Dr. Burr? I just once again want to tell you how grateful we are for you to come, and thank you for your dedication.
Thank you very much.
And for your service, your 33 years of military service to our country, and
that's a long time.
For all this medical support you're given so many, and just God bless you.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. If there is no more testimony today, I'll adjourn this meeting.